collected 5 different life forms from the darkest corners of the universe. Monsters.
Collision imminent.
Invasive species. Predatory. If we don't lock them down, it will be too late.
Beware, spoiler phobes! You have stumbled into a storm of spoilers, a podcast currently covering the FX on Hulu series Alien Earth. This week, a cyborg meets 2 lost boys and makes a friend through neck two-way radio. Curly, the lost boy girl, makes a move to be Boy Cavalier's favorite, and Wendy is out most of the week for repairs. This week's podcast is split into calm and storm sections. In the first calm section, we will only be talking about the newest episode of Alien Earth, titled Metamorphosis, and the 2 previous episodes of the series for context. Then, after ample warning, we enter the storm section, where Neil and I will speculate where the rest of the series goes, and wildly speculate about the things we might get right, like our sneaking suspicion we didn't see the series' only xenomorph decapitated this week. Why, hello, I'm Dave Gonzalez, and I'm using both my lungs. Thank you very much.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I am looking with my eyes only. And welcome back to a storm of spoilers. But first, some housekeeping. Our upcoming schedule, of course, Wednesday afternoons, late afternoons. You will be, of course, getting our Alien Earth podcasts. You'll also be able to, a little bit later in the week now, get them on YouTube if you are so inclined as to want to see Dave and I's facial reactions as we speak the words for this podcast. You know, whatever you're into. I'm not here to judge. So youtube.com/Dave and Neil, DA7ENDNEIL, if you would like to watch us as well, or just continue to follow the feed that you're currently on. You'll get new pods on Wednesday. If you would like to hang out with me a little bit more, I will be streaming Alien Isolation, the video game, on Twitch. It follows the story of Amanda Ripley. It's set a little bit after the events of Alien Earth. And I'm currently on the Sevastopol station running away from a xenomorph, not being killed by aliens, mostly being killed by humans. That is on Twitch, twitch.tv/Neil Stradamus. Every Wednesday evening around 8 o'clock, we get those started. We had good fun last week. I imagine it's going to be terrifying times this week. Dave, I'm mostly just proud to say that I passed the point last week in the game that I gave up. The last time I tried to play Alien Isolation, I very vividly remembered what point it was where I was like, fuck this game, I'm not coming back to it. So already a huge victory in the Twitch stream.
Yeah, wins already in week 1.
Yeah, so good times. Feel free to join me Wednesday evenings. Those are fun. If you'd like to get in touch with this show, some people have. And we're going to talk about those here in a second. You could send us a raven at stormofspoilers@gmail.com. Anything you want to say to us, questions, comments, you can suggest a corner, give us your theories, storm, calm, whatever you want to do. Hit us with whatever you have to say. You can also review us on iTunes and leave us comments on Spotify. Of course, our longstanding rule since the Lost days, the Game of Thrones days, you leave us a 5-star rating, you say whatever you want. Unfortunately, no one has anything to say this week, Dave. No reviews on Apple. I assume that means no one likes us, but, you know, we'll see. We'll see what they have to say. We did get an email, though, from Greg, who says, just now realizing you guys are back and stoked. Thanks, Greg. Wanted to give a shout out to Dennis Taylor's Bobiverse book series as far as a story that really goes deep into the idea of how human consciousness would handle immortality. It's a sci-fi nerd's dream, much in the way Ready Player One was. Highly recommend. Okay, the Ready Player One, this is me speaking. Shaky ground there, Greg, but I'm going to go with you on the Bobiverse. Greg continues, love the first two episodes. I do think there's a bit of Star Wars prequel property feel to it, not simply because things seem more shiny and new, but because of all the questions it raises. Like, wouldn't it have been nice if the Colonial Marines had that gun? I do agree. It would have made a very different movie for James Cameron's Aliens if they would have had that particular gun. But, you know, the Weyland-Yutani Corporation, they seem to not be giving everyone the proper tools to do their job.
Well, also, the gun is non-lethal. So I think the Colonial Marines had the guns they were supposed to. Weren't ready for, like, say, acid splashback or being stalked.
And I also think that what we're learning about this ship, not to get too far ahead of ourselves, because I do have more housekeeping, is that the science crew of the Maginot had was far more ready for whatever they were going to encounter in space than any of the other expeditionary forces we've seen so far in the Alien franchise.
That's true. I've seen a good meme this week, which is like, Alien movies, where did we come from? Is there a God? What are we meant to be? James Cameron's Aliens. What if I duct tape two guns together? That's, you know.
Exactly.
The Alien universe can contain both of those things.
But I can see a scenario where James Cameron is at home watching Alien Earth going, damn, I wish I would have thought of that gun. That is a cool ass gun. All right. One more piece of housekeeping, then we will start the calm. You can join Dave and I if you need more of our content over at Patreon, patreon.com/DaveNeil, DaveNeil. For more content from this feed, bonus content from our Lost rewatch, again, the Game of Thrones era. You can also get Dave and I's Twin Peaks rewatch project. We did a Leftovers rewatch project. We're currently doing a Hannibal rewatch pod, which has been quite a lot of fun. And you can get weekly adventure pod episodes. We're currently in August doing a spoof-a-thon where we're watching. We just did a pod about the Naked Gun movies. We're having quite a bit of fun over there. And most importantly, you get access to our patron Slack, which is the most chill, cool, and least toxic place to discuss pop culture things on the internet, from movies to TV shows to games to food to pet photos to politics and really everything. So it's great. Join us on Patreon. It's awesome. It literally pays my rent. So I appreciate it. All right. That's all the housekeeping. We're going to kick off the calm this week, Dave, with another Raven. This one, I think, really goes to maybe one of the bigger discussions this week about the Lost Boys in a corner that I'm calling Mother Sender Raven.
Okay.
This one is from a longtime emailer, Phelan, who actually sent us two this week. One was a very long one, and then I believe Phelan didn't think that one went through, so he followed up with a more summarized version, which I appreciated. So I'm going to read the shorter one. Phelan says, expanding on the Neverland themes, I was thinking about who else in our cast fits into the Peter Pan allegories. And though it's more obvious after today's episode, Morrow seems to be our proxy for Captain Hook. He's got the deadly prosthetic appendage, and now he's menacing the Lost Boys. That observation appears to be confirmed. Morrow literally means the next day. In a show about a boy cheating time to never grow up, that name seems deliberately adversarial. I speculated that he could have been a double agent working for one of the other companies, and while I was wrong there, I was correct in the assumption that distinguishing him as a cyborg, not a synth, means he could, in theory, put self-interest over that of the company. Hook was a pirate, after all. We may see him turn on Yutani yet. I mean, I feel like we're already seeing him sort of distance himself from Yutani. Anyway, back to Phelan's email. Hook's other main adversary, besides Peter Pan, is the crocodile that ate his hand. We all remember the crocodile swallowed a clock, and the sound of ticking meant the crocodile was drawing near. I think our xenomorph communicating with the high-frequency screeching clicks that only the hybrids can hear is a subtle wink to that, and the learning French bit was absolutely foreshadowing that Wendy's going to learn to talk to these fuckers. Lastly, if we establish that the xenomorph hunt hunts based on fear. Morrow surviving the elevator encounter by closing his eyes and meditating with his back turned appears to me to be a clever reference to thinking happy thoughts, which, as we know, is how we fly. I bet that comes up again. So this is pretty on the nose, pretty spot on analysis here from Phelan. I also, this was sort of the thing I was thinking about last week, which is like, who are the one-to-ones from the Peter Pan story? Obviously, Boy Cavalier is our boy who doesn't want to grow up, and the Lost Boys all have literal names. The Captain Hook thing should have clicked with me last week for Morrow, him literally having a sword hand.
Right, a hand. Appendage hand.
But I've been, the other one that I was wondering about, Dave, was Tinkerbell. Who is the Tinkerbell? And it wasn't until this week when we get a little bit more about Curly and her ambition, I guess, that it's starting to feel like maybe she could be in that zone. Although, you know, as she even says in the episode, Curly was a little bit of a troublemaker. And I'm not entirely sure that Curly isn't the troublemaker of this group. Based on this conversation that she has with Boy Cavalier, right? It's most of it is framed around her, you know, being a little bit jealous of Wendy in that childlike way of like, I want to be the favorite. How do I become the favorite? But she also sort of seeds this idea that she wants to replace Boy Cavalier. And I feel like, you know, there are a number of things coming for this dude. This trillionaire guy, right? Obviously, he has now let the monsters into his secure island, and that is a problem. He literally almost walks himself right into becoming a facehugger bait, and that's a problem for him. And I think, obviously, Wendy is very powerful and has the potential to, you know, if she decides to sort of take him on, maybe upset his, especially once she finds out what he did to her brother, you know, upset his order and his situation. But I think Curly's ambition is interesting in the way that if she wants to replace him, there's like a nice way to do that, right? There's, you know, the, I want to succeed you and be your mentee and we can, you know, play as he suggests in a, I guess, hopefully intellectual way,
possible language,
or there could be a nefarious way that she could do that. You know, we talked about this last week too, about like, is there a difference between Wendy's powers as being the first one and the other Lost Boys, or they all have sort of the same potential? If they all have sort of the same potential, I would be just as scared of Curly as I would be of Wendy. But her need to be sort of recognized, her need to be believed in, I guess, sort of is leading her down a Tinkerbell-ish path, at least so far. What do you think?
I like the Tinkerbell sort of grafting on, if we're going to have Peter Pan characters. Especially I like this because it grafts Tinkerbell onto who should by name be a Lost Boy, because I'm not sure exactly how much we should be buying in to like the names and what the Lost Boys are in, say, the Peter Pan stories.
Well, especially because they're already starting to resist that idea, the characters themselves, right? Like they're already like Nibs is like, why didn't we get to choose our names, you know?
Yeah. So I really appreciate that. I do like this idea that maybe there's something special about Wendy, because I think even in our email from Phelan, the idea that we were toying with last week that maybe just the hybrids could hear the eggs, I seem more convinced this week that it is just Wendy who could hear the eggs.
Yeah, because otherwise the two hybrids in the room with with Timothy Oliphant's character would have also heard them, right?
In theory, yes. Yeah. And that was Curly and Toodles, which are the two that I am, you know, am most side-eyeing because they seem most into just doing what the company is saying they're going to do, which mm-hmm. sort of lines up with what Curly says in this episode, which that the character was occasionally called Pickles because he always get himself in a pickle. And then Toodles, who is actually kind of the opposite in the story, which is most of the time when there's a big scrape, Toodles is off doing something else. So putting those two characters together is interesting, but that's only if we think we could really map these one-to-one. But I definitely think Maro Captain Hook versus the Boy Cavalier Peter Pan is a great one-to-one. Sure. And I was a little bit more convinced when we get sort of the screen history of Prodigy on this episode, when Maro's looking at it, sort of like the Windows 95 browser hyperlinks, where the first one is he was in like a crazy car crash when he was 15 mm-hmm. and survived. And people are wondering why didn't he, you know, use AI. And, you know, it's part of the story that Boy Cavalier is Cavalier. It's right in his name and he is a boy. But also that was very similar to how the Peter Pan character came about initially, was that J.M. Barrie's older teenage brother died in his teens. And he, in order to help comfort his mom, would like dress up in his clothes. And his mom would be like, oh, you know, my boy, he's forever a boy. And that's sort of where the idea of Peter Pan latched into J.M. Barrie's you know, life, and that he would later develop into a play and then the novels.
Wow.
So
some yeah. people, instead of going to therapy, just create Peter Pan.
Just create Peter Pan. And there's also this question later in the sort of newswire scroll that he threw himself into his work after the death of his, and then the article cuts off. Mm-hmm. So an interesting world building episode, not only for the things you could press pause on, but for the world of Alien Earth and just how far we're going to take this Peter Pan metaphor. I am not exactly sure. I mean, a lot of it is just a lot more fun if you're just playing in the world of like Peter Pan. Like if the xenomorph is something like the crocodile, is the fact that we like, you know, used a hook to hook its tongue off in this episode, also a hook based Peter Pan, or is it just because they were in a meat truck and why wouldn't there be a hook there?
Yeah. So, or is Noah Hawley, who known liar, Noah Hawley, mm-hmm. has already lied to us once about there being only one xenomorph in this show. Is the Peter Pan metaphor a distraction of some kind? You know, is it being used to misdirect the audience? From what we don't entirely know just yet. But I think that specifically because the Peter Pan thing is an in-universe creation by Boy Cavalier, I don't think we should trust it implicitly, right?
Yeah. I do think there is a slight possibility that we are contained on an island full of monsters. And at the end of the Peter Pan narrative, because there is, as we all know, a movie called Hook, some of the Lost Boys and Wendy and her family get to leave the island. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's where it's going to come up again, is if at the end of this show, some people get to leave, it'll not be Peter, it'll not be Hook, it'll not be Tinkerbell. Mm-hmm. That I could maybe see coming together. So that bad news for Curly, I guess, if those things end up being true.
I mean, I'm rooting for you, Wendy.
Yeah. Well, we don't get a lot of new information about Wendy this week, but what we do does make me a little bit more scared as to what else is going on.
Except,
on the island.
She's very strong.
She is. She's very strong. And I guess this is as good of a place as ever to talk about the fight between Wendy and the Olympian xenomorph, rest mm-hmm. in peace. Which I really appreciated how vague it was, because when the sequence started, I was really liking it. I like that Joe is sort of half cocooned to a wall. That's a great nod to the deleted scene of Dallas being cocooned in the first Alien. So we know that a solo xenomorph will start cocooning, even if it doesn't know it has eggs. It's just that's what its impulse is. We would think this one seems slightly smarter.
Sure. This one also probably knows that it has eggs, right? Because it starts in the room with the eggs.
Yes.
When it takes Joe out the window. So
correct.
You know, this so one is already sort of mid-plan, mid-scheme.
Right, it's ready to wasp up Joe. And so Wendy comes in, gets him out, which I think is great. The xenomorph seems to sort of like back off Wendy, which again is something we need to keep an eye on because we usually only see that. We see that with Morrow sort of not having fear, which might be a good enough reason, but she had somebody that seemed to be absolutely terrified behind her.
Sure.
So I'm wondering if this is more like a Alien 3 where the xenomorph doesn't want to hurt Wendy because it senses something in Wendy that is ultimately going to help it.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows how smart it is. Anyway. Or
her lack of being human, I guess.
Right.
One thing. I also love the design of this entire sequence, right? One of the things that really jumps off about this episode is how well this show is sort of knowing its limitations, but also I love the production design of this space, right? The cargo, these, what are they called?
Like a hold?
The containers, shipping containers. That's what
I was. Oh, the shipping container. Yeah.
The shipping container is cool.
Shipping container.
Like a meat locker, but also like the fact that it's like this, you know, industrial basement and it's like extremely wet. Yeah, I don't know. It all reads as very Alien to me. Alien franchise. Absolutely. TM style, you know?
So the alien backs out. He goes on top of the container. And then she stabs up through the container with her, if I recall correctly, paper cutter sword.
Yeah.
So then I was like, okay, sequence. Hold on here. I don't know how steel works. But like you said, she is very strong.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's just a strong enough pointy thing's going to bust through anything. And then we have the whole sequence where xenomorph rolls the container. Joe comes out, gets Bishop stabbed through the chest and thrown. And then Wendy comes back just in time to hook the Olympian right through his tongue. And right there, I was like, okay, Alien Earth, your next few seconds are really going to decide how much I trust you with treating the xenomorph like a threat that it should be. Because I've seen lots of things fight xenomorphs. I've seen nothing be able to like kind of control it with its tongue. Let's see what happens. And they were smart enough to construct the sequence where ultimately the fight happens behind a door and we get sort of like a Looney Tunes bam ooh sort of sound recreation. And then when the door opens up, she's bleeding from the top of the head. I don't know why. Mm-hmm. And so then she passes out and we see that she's decapitated the xenomorph. I think that is something that is better off inferred rather than shown to keep the threat of the alien sort of like where it needs to be.
Yeah.
Because that sequence, I ultimately like it because we get some great xenomorph action, but really rides the line between how deadly is this thing. Or I guess also raises the stakes of how deadly are our hybrids once they have something to actually fight for instead of cowering like children or touching their own eyeball, which is gross.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think it toes the line really well and between right on the line of not giving Wendy too much power, right? Like too much physical power, right? Because if...
Mm-hmm.
We still need xenomorphs to be a threat to her.
Yeah.
Right. So the fact that it all happens behind a door, she does defeat it, but she goes down, right? Like we know she's not dead because she's, you know, a synthetic, but she goes down in such a horrific way that Joe like immediately pukes over her body.
Right.
And it's a pretty, pretty gnarly scene. And I like that part about it because even though she is strong enough to sort of drag it around, I think mostly because she kind of catches it by surprise, right? Does a classic Ripley move. Like you and I, we just not long ago rewatched Alien Resurrection, and ripping the tongue guy out is a classic.
Yeah, that seems to be the most reliable way to control an alien for a little bit is just go for the tongue mouth.
And for reference, that is something that Ripley could only do after she had become a super strong clone version of herself. So
yes,
human Ellen Ripley would not have been able to do that, I don't think. So I think that it tracks. In world, still sort of within the bounds of believability. So yeah, I dug it. I think the visual of the xenomorph beheaded is really cool at the end. I do kind of have some questions about the acidic blood rules and whether we're breaking those in any way, right? Because they do show it obviously going through the shipping container, and Joe recognizes it as being acid and sort of gets out of the way. But it's not like burning through the ground after the xenomorph is dead. And then later when they're taking it back to the island, they put it on this like tray.
Yeah.
So clearly on Earth, they have some materials that can withstand that acid, I guess. Whereas previously in Alien, that acidic blood could literally rip through the hull of a spaceship if it got, you know, in the wrong spot. So I think that's kind of interesting. Then again, like, you can't, you know, how far do you take that? Like, does the acid just keep going until it gets to the center of the Earth? Like,
right.
How acidic
that's,
is
I think,
it?
The thing is, it's in space and it's dealing with, like, these spaceships aren't designed to deal with interior acid. That's just not something that they would think about doing. If I have like the most corrosive acid I could think about and I go outside and I drop it on the dirt, it's not going to go to the center of the Earth. At some point, it's going to be neutralized. So I assume if acid is acid, you have some sort of like base neutralizing trolley that you could carry things on. It's very heavy. We could see that the forklift they're using has like the power loader clamps from Alien 2, which I thought was really fun. So it's a big, heavy boy. And it is sort of like steaming a little bit when they bring it in for its procession. But I do think, so the fight with like the shipping containers and stuff was in the building, not the crash site.
Right.
Because she jumped out of the crash and then ran through all the tunnels. So I think that's just like Earth. Like, maybe it made a dent like in the concrete or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it's going to go maybe down to the basement at worst. But I do like, you brought it up before. Actually, maybe this is the best time to talk about the mixing of our sort of sets and our extensions and then our practical effects for our deploy the polygon probe segment. Not as many full digital effects this week, which I guess should be expected. We didn't have a gigantic plane crash. But in terms of the action, I think a lot of it was practical. I think a lot of the dissection of the facehugger was practical, which is coming from a long tradition of those dissections of facehuggers being practical. And then I believe that most of our digital effects were either set extensions to continue the world building, our exterior of the Prodigy New Siam. Obviously, none of that is fully real. It's sort of pasted on top of the actual shooting location. And then some stuff inside containers. But I think a lot of it has been pretty practical. Was there anything that sort of stood out to you as inherently digital or maybe a little bit too digital?
I actually thought everything looked a lot better this week. I mean, I think there were two like cityscape shots that I thought, I mean, obviously stood out to me as being like, oh, these are their digital shots. I think there was like the sunrise time lapse shot of like the building, but I actually thought that looked cool. That looked a lot better than some of the stuff we saw last week. And I think this is, you know, now that they've got the big crash sequence out of the way, the show definitely seems to have a better grip on its limitations. And especially for a TV show, you know, even though it's an expensive TV show, it's operating on a TV show budget. And I think that its focus by primarily setting a lot of this in close quarters allows them to do more practical xenomorph stuff and more, you know, the more practical stuff with the eggs and whatnot. I do wonder if how practical the facehugger dissection scene was, because I remember, you know, when we did our Alien series for the Adventure Pod, we were digging in some of the behind the scenes, and there's this great story about Ridley Scott intentionally picking like very smelly shellfish as part of the interior of the facehugger for the scene where Ian Holm is dissecting the facehugger, and it's like, yeah, it's like oysters and scallops, and like it was specifically very gross, and that's one of the things that like helped inform the performance, because like the actors are genuinely disgusted. I doubt that they were doing that to Timothy Oliphant in this, but it looked great. It looked similarly very, very gross.
I mean, for the most part, Timothy Oliphant, I don't think, is doing the close-up shots. So yeah, that's maybe because the close-up shots, I went back and I looked at my 4K. Yeah, I looked at my 4K Alien version for the original oyster and chicken guts version of the facehugger, and it's pretty close.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I mean, the only like big difference is, well, we've got the, you know, whatever we're going to call the little tadpole monster, which we'll get to in our monster naming segment. Mm-hmm. And then we have the sack that has the acid blood in it. That is sort of new when it comes to it. But I do like, especially when it's like fighting him and he's shocking it, that looks incredibly practical.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're just holding a thing down on top of the table. And then I do appreciate my alien fight that I just broke down also seems to be entirely due to the suit.
Yeah.
Which is the way to do it and save some money, especially on a week where we don't have to have any Mr. Octo or Stephen Miller worm action.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think the other visual effects note that I made is just that the show benefits quite a bit now from the change in setting. So now that we've got the team away from the crash site, I feel like, you know, we still have Mr. Morrow roaming around New Siam, but that's street level. You know, there's cool streets in Bangkok that they can shoot on that look futuristic, and you know, the rest is just set extensions. But you'll note how good the visual effects look like when they're flying back to the island, right?
Yes,
that kind of stuff, similar to like when we were talking about Andor and you get spaceships out in space and it's all digital. That's the stuff that looks great because there's no seams, right? It's just all of a full digital creation. So I think that now that we're on the island, we're going to be in potentially some really good looking territory. Like I don't think we're going to have quite as many seams to even contend with some of this stuff, especially if when the next xenomorph shows up, if it continues to be a guy in a suit, which I imagine it will be. So I think they've kind of gotten through, at least in this first part of the season, the more challenging visual effects stuff. And now we're into the juicy practical effects bonanza that we've been hoping for.
Yeah.
Goopy practical effects bonanza.
And I love that the goo is now inside a facility where we may not be in space, but we're not that far out of space. That this episode was really good in terms of moving the action to Neverland. And now I'm like, okay, this makes so much more sense. I had so many questions when the series began. I'm like, how can you have a xenomorph on Earth and us have no idea what the xenomorph is? How can you have a xenomorph on Earth when most of the other alien projects, AVPs excluded, have been about how these things cannot get to Earth? Mm-hmm. And now that they've set it on Neverland entirely, it seems, who knows where the series goes, because we did do two episodes that was essentially rescue a ship and now we're to a new location. But it does seem like this is a television trope that Noah Hawley, I think, also used to great purpose in Legion season 2, which is have a home base for these people where they could split off, have their side conversations. It's basically like a spaceship, but it's an island.
Sure.
And so we could get these great flora and fauna of Earth panoramic things, but mostly our characters are stuck inside where cameras see everything and there's still a dude misting the walls for some reason.
Well, yeah, and I kind of like that it's contained enough. I mean, not to get too Alien versus Predator Requiem with it, but it's contained enough to, like, I don't know, man, if Ms. Yutani decides to just shoot a nuke at that island, then that's it. No one's ever going to hear about a xenomorph again on Earth for a while.
Yeah. So it's going to be interesting to see what the stakes are or to what degree nuking it is just the answer. Because we are in this episode, I believe, in the grace period where Yutani has just learned what's going on and we haven't seen what her official reaction is going to be yet, because it does seem like her first attempt was to try to get Maro to come back in and be part of whatever her official reaction is going to be. Mm-hmm. But now Maro has, I don't know, gone rogue for the company. Like, let's move on to what you are calling the Brett and Parker Memorial character who most needs a union award, because I would say Maro is a little too attached to this company. Don't do overtime because you feel like you need to and assume the company is going to pay you for it. That's, I think, my real sort of.
Absolutely. Yes.
Lesson tomorrow.
Well, yes. And this corner, of course, named for Brett and Parker, the characters played by Harry Dean Stanton and Yaphet Kotto in the original Alien, who were the characters in that movie who most needed to unionize against the company and were most exploited by Weyland Yutani. But I think there's many examples. And yeah, Maro, you know, she even brings up his contract in this. And I think, you know, he mentions having had a daughter, although we don't know what happened to his daughter. She may have been gone prior to him leaving, but like he's been gone for 65 years. That's right. Quite a lot of time to give to a company. And I do wonder, you know, Phelan mentioned in his email that we read at the top about the potential of him being like a double agent or turning on the company in some way. I wonder whether it is a commitment to the company or, as he says in this episode, there is something about these creatures, about these specimens that he is now attached to emotionally, I guess, or however emotional a cyborg can be, to where he needs to see this thing through. And I kind of wonder what that is. There's so many questions about Moro's motivations that I think you could read as him being committed to the mission of the Weyland Yutani science mission, or could be sabotaging the Weyland Yutani science mission. Because even from the beginning, I was like, why is he crashing it on Earth? Like, why did he specifically, like, point the, you know, say that, like, oh, we have to crash land on Earth instead of, like, crashing that ship into the moon? Or, you know, I guess because another company owns the moon. Or, like,
Dynamic.
Yeah, Dynamic owns the moon. But, you know, so I wonder if there are underlying motives that he is he's working with here, or if he is going to end up being a company man. I do, though, like the positioning of the Yutani situation, as she's going to do something. And that kind of leads me to believe that by the end of this, we could have a big scale conflict between Prodigy and Yutani. Like, Yutani sends forces to invade the island, and we could have kind of like a battle episode from Alien Earth, yeah, which would be fun. You know, like, what if there was a Colonial Marines battle on this island? That could be fun. But my big labor question for Maro is he getting hazard pay for this? And I doubt it. I don't think he is. So that's probably the number one labor question.
I'd like that you brought up why crash it into Earth, because there has been some chatter amongst the fandom that this was all about how this week they said Prodigy was like weeks away from launching these like hybrids, that this was actually corporate sabotage, in the sense that they're like, we could probably recover some eggs. If not, we could have these space truckers on the Nostromo swing by and do it. So why not just use this one as a giant missile into a Prodigy city?
Sure.
Which I think is a possibility. I think it's only a possibility because if that was Yutani's goal, they would not have told anybody, let alone Moro. Even if Moro was the instrument of it, they wouldn't have been like, we're doing this because of this.
Sure.
They just would have told him to do only it because he had to do it
at that point.
Right. So I feel like there's a way where I like Moro because he's now the wild card. And I have a lot of questions with him. No matter how much time I spend with him, none of my questions are answered. So he's an intriguing character that I want to see why he's doing all of this. But I also think because of the nature of secrecy, I think ultimately being the downfall of Weyland-Yutani for various reasons, we could see that play out here. So I'm not 100% sure to say that he's a villain, even though he's our Captain Hook.
Sure.
Analog at the moment.
I mean, I also think it's entirely possible that he is somehow in league with the monsters, right?
Yeah.
that like the reason why he wanted to crash it on Earth is because he's like, maybe humanity's time is over. Maybe it's time to give the xenomorph. Maybe it's time to hand Earth over to the xenomorph.
Yeah.
For what reason we don't know, but you know, he's not entirely human anymore. So,
well. We also learned this episode that the Lost Boys learned that they have everything filmed through their eyes, which we learned during last week's batch of episodes. But now they learn it.
Wild.
And they don't seem to like it, rightfully so. But I do have a question, which is if the Lost Boys are basically recording everything that they go through and it can be even played back, which is, I think, my assumption when the Prodigy executive is... talking to the boys, then does Prodigy know Moro is communicating with Slightly through the little implanted thing?
I mean, would have to. I don't know at least,
if they could hear his side, but they definitely know he's talking to himself.
They would at least have Slightly's side. And I guess, like, you know, we see it's not just that they're recording through the eyes. There's, you know, double-sided mirrors everywhere. In this place, there's cameras all over the place recording them. You know, it's this severe lack of privacy, and it's a huge question of obviously consent, right? These children were unable to consent to this, but like I have some questions for their parents, right? Like, is it worth it to save your child if your child is never ever going to have any sort of autonomy again in their life now that they've got this new body? You know, I wonder if the show is ever going to go back and address that, like if any of these kids are ever going to, because, you know, they keep questioning, like, are we ever going to go home? Are we ever going to have a conversation with any of these children's parents who gave them up to this program? Or, you know, did they just sign their kids away forever?
I think we're about to see, especially with what we see with Curly this episode, we're about to see what happens if some of these kids push their boundaries in certain directions. Mm-hmm. I wonder if there is like some sort of programming backdoor that makes these bodies different from the ones that they were going to market. If they're going to market the technology, I don't think people are signing up to be immortal if they're also signing up to have all their life data be part of Prodigy.
Then again,
I mean,
if this is a metaphor, if Boy Cavalier is an analog to our current slew of billionaire boys, them duping the larger public into stealing all of their private information and that being the ultimate product is a pretty on point metaphor, right? Like if it's about, oh, I'll give you immortality, but deep in the terms and conditions, I get to see everything you do forever. That's like what Facebook did,
right?
In the 21st century. So,
and already might be implemented, because the other point we have here is Joe's lack of body autonomy. And in an interview, the actor who played Boy Cavalier is like, oh yeah, he's basically my property. So in theory, maybe being a Prodigy citizen means that they already own all of that stuff for you. Yep. Because Joe, definitely not able to consent, his lung is now being used for a bioweapons experiment.
Yeah, number one, I think winner of this award this week is Joe. At the end, because like when the scene starts, I was thinking, oh, well, that's nice. They're fixing Joe, the company. It's good that they're keeping him alive. Wendy's going to be happy that her brother's not dead. Oh, shit. No, they're actually taking out his lung. I assume they're giving him a replacement, you know, cyborg lung.
Yeah, make him a cyborg.
Which is, you know, good for him. I guess he gets to keep going. But he didn't really get to choose to give up his organic lung to become fodder for xenomorph experiments, which, you know, visually I appreciate that he made that sacrifice. It's very cool. But from a workers' rights standpoint, this is not a future that humanity should aspire to.
Nope.
This is bad.
I like this new layer because the more complex that we make, I think, the companies that are controlling Earth and the hybrids versus the cyborgs, there are all these like stories that I would like to see play out. And I'm pretty sure this season's about the alien. Mm-hmm. So it gives me great hope that this story world, as it's being built out, it keeps revealing new avenues that I would like to go down instead of starting to restrict itself.
Well, and this to me is one of the core essential themes of the entire Alien franchise, which is about corporate, greed and workers' rights, and how corporations in the future in this story world have gone to great extremes to sort of be these invasive entities in people's lives and disregard, you know, human autonomy. And it's wild that, like, that seemed like a pretty radical idea in 1979 to put in your movie, and it's only gotten more prescient here in 2025, and I feel like it's only gotten a little bit worse, or a lot worse in many ways in our real world.
Oh yeah.
So it's like, as we in the real world inch closer and closer to a world where a company could own you, I like that Alien Earth has not lost sight of that very core piece of the puzzle for this story world.
It's definitely the same company that sent an entire terraforming colony to a moon they knew had alien eggs on it in Aliens. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad we're getting there. I'm interested, or I'm actually very happy that we've transitioned to this more controlled, sterile environment, but we still have these class questions, because it would also be super easy to be like, we're in the hell of this Dante's Inferno, and everybody involved in the story from this point out is sort of like doomed because they reach beyond their means.
Sure.
The hybrids make that me not think about that, and then Joe being still involved.
Joe's still involved. The other soldiers are still around. Now they're the Neverland. I'm interested to see how they, I was kind of glad that they're still here, because, you know, not only do we need humans to become infected by facehuggers, but, everybody can't be a very, extremely strong hybrid that can't die. We need that human element.
We need some bodies.
Yep.
So let's talk a little bit about stuff that we learned about the hybrids this week. Obviously, it's just the question of how can Wendy hear the xenomorph eggs? Mm-hmm. I don't know if we have enough information in the show to say that, unless there's something that I missed. Do you have a weird idea from the three episodes we've seen about how Wendy could hear these xenomorph eggs or no one else can?
I mean, there's two possibilities in my mind. One is that it's simply just the show further signaling that Wendy is different than the other hybrids, for whatever reason. You know, maybe because she was first, or Boy Cavalier, there's something special about her that Boy Cavalier is not telling us, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe she's his favorite for other reasons, not just because she was the first one. Or maybe that fight that happened behind a closed door, something happened to her that we didn't see, that gives her some sort of connection, right? Like, you know, maybe the hybrids can't be infected like a human by the parasite of the facehuggers, but maybe coming into that close of contact with a xenomorph did something to her. right? Or or it has caused some sort of physiological change. You know, we'll see. Then again, like, it was clear that she had extremely heightened. The show has pointed it out multiple times already. She has extremely heightened hearing senses. So that could just be it. Maybe that's her special talent.
She could hear better than the rest?
Yep.
She seems to also be the only one who has figured out, even if it's just through emotional sense, how to reverse hack the entire Prodigy state. Mm-hmm. So it's possible that her hearing the xenomorphs is not only her sense of hearing, but her input from something she doesn't know that she's accessing yet.
Yeah.
Well, and I think is like possible.
This goes to a question that I still would like an answer to from the show, which is how much time passed between when Wendy got her new body and when the others started getting the new bodies, right? Because you know, in those first two episodes, it was sort of rapid fire. But then again, we did see Wendy in her new body interacting with the other children before they went through the process. So she has maybe had a lot more time to acclimate to her abilities than the others. They may still be figuring it out, right? Like, she may have already had time to go through her, you know, existential crisis that Nibs is going through. And, you know, maybe she's already figured all that shit out. So it might just be a matter of, like, over time, she's unlocking the potential, you know, kind of like how Curly mentions that, like, she's learning and she's downloading French and she's sort of gaining steam the longer she's in this new body. And it's as she accepts it, right? And I think one of the questions that this show is going to continue to ask us is, like, how does this hybridization change these children? But right. It's like, the longer they go on, if they acclimate well, maybe they get superpowers. And if they don't, maybe they lose their minds. And I think the bigger question is, like, has Wendy been in this hybrid body a lot longer than the others? And is that part of why she can do things the others can't? Which suggests that the others may be able to do these things later.
I like this also because you brought me to something I do want to talk about, which is downloading information. Mm. Because we see Timothy Oliphant's Kirsch reading basically the files on all the species, and he reports back to Kid Boy Cavalier. Boy Cavalier's like, get the species, cool. But it seems like since Kirsch found that computer, you know, look, don't touch, he's been reading the files on the things that the alien picked up. Mm-hmm. A little bit later, Morrow seems to download all of that to his cyborg hard drive brain, which we didn't know he had a hard drive in the brain, but it seems like that interface seems to work.
Visually very cool. I really like the pulsing lights. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's another great sequence that could have had so many special effects, but was just like a screen projecting some vector graphics and some lights on a rope light. Pretty great. And then we get this mention from Curly that she downloaded like the French lessons, and she refers to her brain sort of like a hard drive. So that being said, I have two questions. One, do you think they have all the same type of hard drive? Like, is this interface, can we just exchange information brain to brain? Can cyborgs and hybrids sort of like communicate faster through like some sort of download? And then two, does the, you know, sort of ability to download things and then delete them mean that Kirsch has there are two working file sets? There's whatever Kirsch remembers, because it seems like he knows a little bit about the egg and obviously kind of knows where to look in the facehugger. So he probably looked up some of those things on the files before he took it out. And then Morrow has the rest of the data. Mm-hmm. So do we consider that two pieces of data, or do I just assume Kirsch can't read as fast as the download goes?
I mean, that's a good question. Like, I would assume that maybe there's more to it. right? Because Kirsch was processing it a little bit more slowly by just like reading it. He would, mm-hmm. although he did plug himself in, right? Didn't he plug it into his arm?
Yeah, like earlier, just to like help scroll through. I read it just like to help scroll through it, but maybe he was downloading a little bit. Okay. It does seem like.
So I think it's possible that they both have the same amount of data.
Yeah, I mean, you think Kirsch also knows like other stuff Mother would know?
Maybe. Then again, Morrow being a Weyland Yutani employee and being a member of the crew, and he may have access to higher level stuff. Right, like Kirsch may be able to read like the same files that like every crew member would have been able to read on the Maginot, mm-hmm. but Morrow has like the secret files, the secret you know crash into Earth you know orders files you know the actual plans for the mission type stuff, you know the type of stuff that you would want to erase at the end after you've downloaded them, so. Then again, it will be interesting to see because we have so many characters on the board that have hard drives, right? And mm-hmm. Wi-Fi built in. Will anyone be able to take that from Morrow, right? Because his story momentum is going to eventually probably take him to the island. So once he comes back into contact with Kirsch or any of the hybrids, once they know that if they know that they need more information from him, will they try and steal that from him in some way? And how sweaty will it make him? This is another question.
Morrow, super sweaty. Not because he's in the S&M dungeon.
Yes.
But just because naturally.
Yeah. Well, you know, cyborgs, they get real sweaty when they're downloading and uploading large packets of information.
I mean, I guess it's interesting how much with Morrow we're just like accepting intent because he has the slightest bit of emotion. Mm-hmm. But like also when he started downloading things into his brain, I'm like, maybe Morrow's actually, what went wrong with cyborgs to make hybrids a necessary step? Mm. Because if this dude has emotions, was able to procreate, and has a hard drive brain, What's the benefit of Wendy and the Lost Boys and their hybrids? Here's another thing that I didn't realize I needed to see until Wendy started bleeding white just from the top of her head. Are those synth bodies? What? Like, they don't need to poop and whatnot, but are they just synth? Like, if we open them up? Yeah.
I mean, do we
know that for sure?
I mean, especially now that we've seen her bleed white.
Well, like, but most of the time when we see synths in other alien media, they get like really dismembered. Mm-hmm. And it's very obvious that there's synths. Like, what happens if you cut her arm and she bleeds red? You know, sure. Like, we know the brain is somewhat synthetic. She has, you know, powers. But in this world of, are we also bioengineering these aliens to make better what? Maybe the hybrids are also slightly more than human on the synth side in some sort of way that would make them better than synths. I don't know.
Although I will say the greater question for me, and this kind of goes back to the question about the cyborg, is to what extent do these characters ultimately have autonomy? Because one of the questions I keep having with Morrow is Morrow fully in control of himself? Mm. Or is there at any point, can Yutani flip a switch and make him do stuff, right? Like we know that the Lost Boys don't have privacy, but is there like a kill switch if one of them tries it's to like go after Boy Cavalier? Right.
It's like a Repo Man problem.
Can they be remote controlled?
Are parts of his body owned by the company? Like, yeah. Joe's body is owned by the company.
Yeah, like if Yutani and Morrow were in a room and he decided that he was going to try and stab her with his sword arm, could she shut him down? Like, remotely type of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that goes back to the, you know, obviously questions of people's bodily autonomy versus the corporate interest. And I think that we could get into some of that stuff. And that could be one delineation between the hybrids and the cyborg, but we'll see. A question to be answered later.
Well, then let's ask about our odds of hybridization consent. It's our new corner here. How likely are you to say yes to becoming a hybrid based on the experience the Lost Boys are having with their new bodies? I think, Neil, this is an excellent week to say, to ask this question for the first time, because I think this is going to be the last episode where I'm like, I still like 80% want to become a hybrid.
Yeah, I'm still very high. I think I was very high in this last week. I'm like at 90, 95%, especially when Curly mentions not pooping anymore.
Yeah.
Because let me tell you, I would miss food, I think. Some food, right? Because clearly they don't have to eat if they're not having to digest things. But I would not miss having indigestion or acid reflux or getting sick, right? Food poisoning. I would not miss food poisoning. And so I think that that alone like raises it like 5% for me, where I'm just like, oh, I get to live forever. Sure. Yeah, I guess you get to remote view anything I see, you know, forever, I guess. But I don't have to deal with my human digestive system anymore. That's a perk in my mind, as long as I don't have to go crazy.
Right. I mean, yes, let's move to Nibs after this. I would say a big part of it right now is I would still have to do it when I was a child. And like looking back, I maybe not, would have not decided that was cool as a kid, but having lived my life as a non-hybrid adult, I'm like, you're not going to miss any of that stuff that you're like, you know, like I have a great appreciation for pooping after getting part of my colon removed and reattached and kind of learning how to poop again. Now it's like one of the best parts of my day, but that wouldn't happen if it was like 13-year-old Dave in an android body. 13-year-old Dave had no need for pooping. I'm glad we got to go there. Let's go circle back.
I do think you're right, though, that the show is going to spend the next 6 weeks trying to talk us out of this.
Right. Because it does seem like Nibs is not having a great time. After being attacked by Mr. Octo last episode, she seems to be having a little bit of crisis of conscience about what she is. It is, we are reminded this episode that she was the little girl that asked, when do you get to go home? And Wendy was like, that's the great thing, you don't. She didn't say that's a great thing. She said you don't. And now seems to be having, I don't know, an existential crisis. How would you describe what's happening to Nibs this episode?
Well, it's interesting because it's like part existential crisis, but also we get this like really interesting cross dissolve moment where it looks like she's got her third eye opening up. So I wonder whether it's part crisis, but also part like expansion of her consciousness. That is maybe her just sort of working through the expanded potential of her mind. And what is on the other side of that? We don't quite know yet. I do think it's interesting, though, the cross dissolves, which at least on my social media timeline, we're getting a lot of people clipping this show out of context last week and making fun of it because there's the one with Sydney Chandler and the thing from Ice Age. And people are like, I can't believe this is a real still from this show. I'm like, I can't believe you clipped that out of context and are not mentioning that this is like a thing that the show is visually doing consistently to try and put us in the head of a character, which is like cross dissolving over, you know, their face with what's going on in their head anyway. But I do think it's sort of interesting the way that lined up a little bit. So it's like, part of it, I do think, is like her being freaked out, right? Mm-hmm. By being attacked by the little midge guy, little eyeball guy. And but also kind of freaked out by the entire notion of immortality and not being able to ever sort of go back to her previous life. And you mentioned at the top in the story of Peter Pan that eventually some of these, some of the kids leave Neverland. I think Nibs already wants to leave. Right? So like if there's going to be an escape attempt, I think Nibs is already a top tier candidate for wanting to escape the island.
If I'm doing just broad visualization allegory. Like, she touches the mirror and then she touches her eye, like two things she could be observed through.
Mm-hmm.
And then she walks through the corridor at night and sees the mist spraying guy, but he has his mask up and he's like taking a smoke. Mm-hmm. So like, if I were to, I mean, it's all coded to be like space madness, but if I were to go further down the third eye rabbit hole that you're talking about, she could be seeing through like the artifice of everything, but realizing that the only place she's actually safe and private is in her mind.
Mm.
So like, she could be putting stuff together, and until she acts on it, they won't know. And she's not as dumb as the other Lost Boys who would just come out and talk to each other or draw what they're thinking. She's internalizing it. Is that internalization going to lead her to madness, or is it going to lead her to being somewhat enlightened and not taking the company's bullshit? Is she going to be one of the against the company people, or is she going to join Curly and Toodles in the eager to please the company territory?
Sure.
I think it's going to be interesting to figure out.
Well, and what's ultimately more dangerous if you're Boy Cavalier? A character like Curly, who has sort of come out with it, you know, I want to replace you sort of thing in a relatively benign manner, at least so far. Or the quiet one in the corner who's like secretly putting the plan together to like maybe kill everybody in the room, you know?
Yeah. I could also see her sort of going down to the like the killing everybody in the room thing, where like, what if she realizes she doesn't have emotions she's supposed to have? Because we know mm-hmm. that like without hormones, their emotions are sort of dulled. But like, she went through something horrible with the Mr. Octo, and now she's like realizing she may not be free. I wonder if her initial reaction is just, why am I not feeling anything like I used to remember feeling things, which I would also like to explore. Mm-hmm. I think the power of this episode, Metamorphosis, overall, is that it's not light on the aliens. We're about to talk about the aliens and the change to their entire life cycle. But the things that I'm most interested in the world is the world building around the aliens. This, I think they could have aired all three episodes at once and I'd still be on board for this series. Even though last week I would have been on board if we spent, you know, two more hours searching through the ship. So I'm very excited by like the breadth of this series going forward. And the things that I'm interested in are not necessarily the alien things, mm-hmm. although I am very interested in those. Which I guess brings us to our monster index. So last week we named the monsters we saw. This week I have two more at least. We see maybe a third. I've been scrubbing through the episode and there is, I don't know, something that looks like it's in a liquid. And then another time we see the leeches sort of in a liquid that they've mm-hmm. already like sort of let some of their blood go. And I'm not sure if those are the two things, but there are two new creatures that I think we need to name. One is one that I call the slime wasp, because this is the flying thing. We've seen it sort of in the background when it was on the Maginot. Now it's been transferred to the Prodigy lab. And it does seem like it's making some goo inside of its tube, which made me think this is part of sort of like the wasp nesting stuff that Joe got involved in. This is part of the insect, part of the alien lore that we've seen, is sort of like this ability to make like a wasp nest. And then last week, I believe in the storm, but maybe in the calm, I was like, oh, it's like a wasp. Maybe it's one of those wasps, but like legs, lays eggs inside of you. That seems like an alien sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this slime wasp. We don't know what it does. I think we could maybe name it. I like slime wasp, but we could also wait to see until it does something.
Yeah. And this is... correct me if I'm wrong, but this is the one that like we keep sort of hearing slam up against its container, right?
Yeah,
like it's moving like around pretty hard in
noises.
There. So it's like, I can't wait to see what this thing does when it gets out, because it seems to want to move very quickly and aggressively. So I'd like slime wasp for now, until we see otherwise what it, you know, looks like and what it can do. You know, I appreciate, I mean, so far, one of the things I appreciate about this show is the goopiness, right? That's yes. another core element of any good alien thing. Is
yeah,
it's
Joe
be
gets
goopy.
Some full KY jelly dripped on his face yeah. this episode.
We got sweaty cyborgs. We got acid all over the place. We got KY. They are the KY jelly budget in Thailand. They have. I don't know. Maybe they're causing supply and demand issues in Thailand with KY jelly, this production. But it's great, and I love it. So can't wait to see what that goop is all about when that slime wasp eventually gets out. I assume all of these things are going to get out. Right. Like you right. don't, you're not, they're not like setting up these monsters to not make an appearance at some point.
It would be funny if there was just one that never got out. Yeah. I mean, a little funny.
Or like if the petal monster just
show,
never
so I don't need
up.
Them to be like, I don't need them to be like each episode, a new monster. So like, it's fine. It would be fine if we don't get to all of them, sure. but I do think it would be funny if it was like, we never go to the slime.
There's
wasp.
Only five of them. So, you know, we got plenty of time.
And then we have the surprise new monster. I'm going to call it for a second the tadpole because mm-hmm. the thing that seems to be gaining traction on Reddit is xenosperm, and I hate it, so no. But this is a thing pulled out of the facehugger and ultimately implanted in one of Joe's lungs. There was some debate amongst the hardcore fans if this is already retconning what we learned in Alien Romulus as Rook sort of said that the facehuggers implanted the black goo into somebody and the black goo would break down the DNA to begin forming something. But then somebody else on Reddit, again, I'm just going to cite Reddit because that's the level of seriousness you should take these things. Neither of Neil or I are doctors, but yeah. It seems like it could be this little thing has some DNA from whatever xenomorph species is coming from. It's not a pure black goo. It is coming from a species that was probably black goo produced, but looks to have like some black goo inside of it.
Sure.
So the idea being that it sort of like releases the black goo to unwind some of the DNA of whatever its host is, and that host DNA combines with the alien, the tadpole DNA to sort of create the ultimate creature.
Yeah. So this and is then, like this is like a black goo tapeworm larva.
Yeah.
Right. Which makes sense, I guess, biologically, in so much as I know biological things, in as to like how the facehugger implants the eventual chest burster into you. Right. This is the little guy that gets into your system and feeds off of you and grows and then eventually explodes out of your chest.
Yes. And so we learned in the first movie. When John Hurt had the facehugger on his face for a long period of time, mm-hmm. that the facehugger, it tightens, and then we learned from Romulus, it tightens a tail around your neck so that it could kill you at any time, but it's also feeding you air.
Mm-hmm.
So some keeping people are like, yep. how can a tadpole exist in a lung? And some people are like, it has always been your lungs.
Mm-hmm.
Like the mouth hole isn't the eat hole, it is the breathe hole.
Yeah.
And so that's what it is doing, is it is implanting something into your lungs that then grows into,
which is really interesting, because in the earlier episodes of the series, when they're going through the ship and they're looking at the sort of aftermath of the crew, there is one person where they're like, this person had a bunch of some sort of foreign entity in its digestive tract.
Yes.
So that suggests that that's not what this is. So there's something correct. Else that got into one of these other five monsters, gets into your intestines and does terrible things, which is even more horrifying, which makes me even more likely to be like, yes, hybridize me. No more poops, no more intestines.
Some of these things won't even try to go for me because they won't see me as human.
But yeah, as a biological explanation for how a chest burster comes to fruition, yeah, in the lungs makes sense, right? Like it feeds you oxygen, it gestates in your lungs, and then it comes straight out of your rib cage where your lungs are. So so far all of this tracks, and I don't think it's upsetting any precious canon. First of all, I don't think there is too much precious canon in the Alien franchise, especially if you were to ask Ridley Scott, he'd be like, who fucking cares? But also because of the sort of nature of the black goo and the xenomorph species being spread so widely across the universe, you know, Morrow says, oh, we went to a remote moon and picked this up. We don't know that that's LV-426. That could be a totally different moon. And again, we don't know that these are directly tied to anything that David was doing in Prometheus and Covenant. It could just be a matter of like that black goo is like the most base element that has is infused in all of these variations, these evolved variations of this creature that eventually lead to a xenomorph coming out of whatever creature it infects. But it you know, needs to have lungs.
Like, to use a Prometheus example, if the engineer drinks black goo, he dissolves, it kills him. Yeah. If they're bombed with black goo, dissolved, kills them. If the black goo goes through an alien host and becomes like Shaw's squid baby from Prometheus and then attacks an engineer, you get a Deacon, which is an alien because it's part engineer, part this other organism that came from the black goo.
Sure.
So you need to go at least one level up from,
but not exactly a xenomorph.
Right. And it's same with Shaw's sort of like alien baby, is someone else got infected with the black goo and then she was impregnated. And so it's sort of like, in order to produce what we see as an alien, which is a gestating thing inside of you, you still need a, I don't want to say two sexes because we don't know if they're two sexes or something, but you need two pieces of DNA to come together.
Sure.
If you just black goo something, it's going to kill it. It's just going to destroy all of the DNA that exists.
Yeah. And the end result, and I think that, you know, we'll get to like the next week on trailer when we get into the storm, but like, what we've seen in some of the previews is a slightly different looking xenomorph.
Yeah.
And I think that the end result will always depend. And this is kind of fun from a storytelling standpoint, which is like, your xenomorph can change because everybody's DNA is different. Every host DNA is different. So the result of the hybrid essentially that comes out of the parasite and the host is always going to just be slightly different, you know, even from human to human.
Or from whatever to whatever. People also online were like, why can't it swim? And people are like, if you are going to be a perfect organism and a facehugger's, you know, tube is of limited length, it is going to need to swim to whatever a lung is in some species. Mm-hmm. So I was mostly excited when I saw him pull a little thing out, because I was like, oh boy, more xenomorph lore. Mm-hmm. And I thought for a while we wouldn't be getting more xenomorph lore in this show, but we will. And I can't wait to see what type of anything comes out of that in a lung.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is.
And
I would think maybe a xenomorph, but who knows?
And I now feel like that now that the cap has been blown off of Noah Hawley's blatant lie that there was only one xenomorph in this show, I think that the potential that we're going to see many xenomorphs or numerous variations of xenomorphs is kind of high, and I love it.
Before we get into looking at our closing hard rock corner with this week's song, I do want to mention here that one of the news scroll items I forgot to mention was the triumvirate becomes the five.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the three big companies get added with, I believe it's Prodigy and Lynch, were the two new companies.
Yeah, the details of this were like, so you start with the three big companies, Weyland-Yutani, Dynamic, and Threshold are the three OG companies that I guess won out in the rampant capitalistic takeover of Earth that took place in the 21st century of this world, which sadly makes sense, I guess, in our world, right? I mean, this is what Amazon, Apple, and X. Sorry. So you have these three companies, and then eventually something happens that causes Prodigy and Lynch to rise up, and they, in this article that we see where the triumvirate is split apart even further, it's said that there, that territory was ceded in North America and Southeast Asia. So I guess Prodigy got land in Southeast Asia and Lynch would have gotten land in North America. Maybe.
Because
I mean, we see Prodigy in Southeast Asia, right? New Siam is in Southeast Asia.
I thought Weyland Yutani controlled both the Americas, though. I thought,
yeah, Weyland Yutani is episode. North and South America. So
they got land from Lynch.
Or Lynch got land from them.
Got it. Yeah. Oh, yeah, but it would have happened. Right. He doesn't know about the triumvirate because that would have happened when he was out like 65
years. He doesn't know about the five. He would have lived in a world where it was the triumvirate.
Right. So the people on the ship would only have known about the triumvirate on the Maginot.
Which is why he is very confused about the city he is in, because New Siam would have been under a completely different, I mean, it might have been Weyland Yutani's back in the day, or it might have been owned by a different company.
Interesting. Somebody also was wondering if that means that two of the triumvirates are actually like little, I don't know, like dummy corps for the other ones to sort of like come about. Like,
maybe.
Most out there theory I read was like Boy Cavalier is a Weyland, which I don't believe because I don't think they'd be fighting as much. But it is interesting that these companies are sort of new and then immediately became dominant. I'll be interested to see if this show cares about any of that background or if that is for another series, an alien Lynch.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, and is there some sort of plot line to be had with Yutani maybe having one of these corporations as a shell corporation to establish some sort of autonomy from after the Weyland Yutani merger, right? Now that now that Weyland's been off planet for a while at this point, is Yutani scheming?
Love to hear it. Can't wait to see how that turns out. And then right before we head to the storm, we do want to talk about our closing rock corner. This one, the second the little string started, once again, I was transported back to my teenage years. This is Wherever I May Roam by Metallica off of the Black Album. And it's pretty cool. They've been using some Metallica in like teasers for like behind the scenes production stuff. And so I was sort of expecting another cut off of this album, but Wherever I May Roam is a great one. Specifically, I wanted to highlight its second verse, which is, "And the earth becomes my throne. I adapt to the unknown. Under wandering stars I've grown, but by myself, but not alone. I ask no one." And that is a couple. It's a couple of characters and non-characters in Alien Earth. So what a great pull. Are you a Metallica fan, Neil?
I mean, not particularly. I was sort of been mad at them ever since they destroyed Napster.
See, I became a Metallica fan pre-Napster, so I do think that's like a generational cutoff.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, why would you pick up Metallica now if everything, you know, great was before?
Yeah. But, you know, the lyrics are, they definitely click, especially, you know, if you think about the journey of the Xenomorph. And the black goop itself has now roamed to Earth. And maybe it is trying to establish some kind of throne. We'll see.
All right. We will see indeed. If you don't want to talk about the next episode of Alien Earth or wildly speculate what might happen in the rest of the season, hop off now. We'll see you next Wednesday. Otherwise, let's head into the storm.
I am the storm. First storm and the last.
All right, Neil, we got to see the episode 4 teaser. Two very interesting things that I saw. We definitely have to talk about the dialogue too, but things that I saw. One, it appears like Mr. Octo is going to be let loose on a sheep.
Poor sheep.
next week's episode, which I think we knew was coming, but is going to be terrifying as we get another Mr. Octo scene. And then the second one is right at the end of the trailer. There's Wendy, who is staring at her brother's lung that is in now a red tinted box. And something comes out and goes in her face. And if you frame by frame it, it is definitely something that I think is larger than the lung, given how much force it comes out with. So the two things that I know are happening next episode is Mr. Octo takes a sheep and something comes out of the lung. As somebody who knows how TV works and knows how a season of television is structured, when do you think in next week's episode we see something come out of the lung?
I mean, especially because we see in this teaser another like fully grown xenomorph, I would imagine pretty early. This is interesting because like my first impulse when I saw the end of this teaser was, is this a vision that she's having? Right. Is she beginning to communicate, and does she have a vision of this thing as it is escaping? You know, where she like, is she not there when it escapes? Or is she there when it escapes and it like starts to attack her, realizes that it can't do anything to her and like runs off. And is that how we get the second xenomorph? We'll see. I do think it'll be interesting to see what it looks like. Like, will it be significantly different in the way it looks to the chest bursters that we've seen previously, because it's only been gestating in a single lung versus having a whole body to gestate off of. But yeah, I think this is xenomorph number two coming in hot, right in Wendy's face. I'm not worried about Wendy. She's survived worse at this point. I also noted that Joe is in several scenes in this teaser looking totally fine. So I guess his cyborg lung is working great. I'm kind of wondering how much, if there's going to be any kind of time jump, or like if we're going to push forward in time a little bit, because there's like scenes of her talking, Wendy talking, where like Joe's behind her and he looks fine. So either medical technology is extremely good, which is possible, or maybe we're gonna span a little bit more time here now that we're on the island, and like this show has fully become, it's in like Jurassic Park mode.
Yeah, there are some scenes also in the next week teaser that involve I'm calling them the scientist parents, because honestly I forget their names, but there's
Dame Sylvia and her husband.
Thank you. Her husband hasn't even had a name yet.
I mean, I'm sure he does. I just don't remember it.
They're sort of discussing, the and then guy. Also on, they're discussing something in sort of like a jungle environment. And there's also a line from the This Season On trailer where they're like, you know, worst case scenario, we have a bunch of AI thinking they're human. Oh no, best case scenario, a bunch of AI thinking the human. Worst case, we just killed six kids. So I think we're going to have that conversation, which I think is going to be, at least when she's discussing that she could talk to them, she's talking to the scientists. Mm-hmm. So I think they're going to try to tweak something. We know that there was the possibility of tweaking sort of like fake hormones, and they were debating that in the first episode. So I think we're going to try to see them either apply what's happening to Wendy to another lost boy. Mm-hmm. I think would be a horrible experiment that they would try. If she could talk to them and they can't, they're going to be like, well, it makes her special. Let's see if we could just hot fix or patch that over another one. Or we're going to start like investigating her family lineage as a family and say it's not the cyborg, it's something else. Mm-hmm. But I think the parents are going to do it. And then we see the dame sort of not tackled. She's sitting in a chair and Nibs jumps on top of her and sort of like gets really close to her face.
Sure. But what could just be because a very this is alien, contentious it looks aggressive. Therapy moment.
Yeah. But I think it is also an interesting thing to watch. The thing I had on with this episode 4 teaser is I obviously want to see what the new xenomorph looks like and what comes out of that lung. But I was reminded of the shot of the Lost Boys sort of in like a prison we were talking about last week in the storm. You're like, I think at some point they go rogue. And so I went back and I looked, and it is right over that time of the dame's husband saying we would kill six kids. And I went back and looked. There are five kids in that shot. Toodles is not in the cage. So I'm going to begin Toodles watch.
Okay.
Why is the dude not in the cage? Is it because he's based off of his Peter Pan character and is off doing something else when danger actually hits and he's just not involved? Or is Toodles the character we're going to use because he is very participatory in the lab and does seem very interested and maybe doesn't, he's the one who tries to touch the screen in the episode and Kirsch tells him not to. Is he going to go too far and is he going to be the first, you know, are they put in a cage to protect them? Not necessarily because they went rogue.
Yeah.
Because something ripped Toodles apart.
Is he going to be the first $1 billion piece of equipment to go down? That could be very interesting. Yeah. Or, I mean, I feel like there's a lot of potential here. Or, are they start, do the hybrids start to act out in some way, right? In a way that starts to break away from the interests of Boy Cavalier to the point where he would want to contain them in a way that might have the two guardian figures, Dame Sylvia and her husband, helping them, right? Like maybe a conspiracy is brewing among the Lost Boys to, you know, work against Boy Cavalier here. And maybe Toodles isn't down with that. Maybe he turns on him. Who knows? So I think that there are a lot of different possibilities here. And I feel like going along with the Lost Boys, you know, sort of bucking against the company is one way for the Guardians characters to be putting them in danger, and they would be very worried about that, but they also care quite a bit about them, so that still might override, like they still might want to participate in helping them you know, achieve some sort of freedom.
I'm going to go back to my original question, and I think the thing coming out of the lung might be the end of the episode, because the episode after next week's episode, next week's episode is called Observation. So I do think we're going to see a lot of them attempting to test all of these alien species to sort of see what they do. But I also think the one person who's maybe observing the observers would be Nibs. So maybe that applies to her there. All that being said, we also have another plot, which is Morrow gets... tells Slightly he wants him to get an egg and to bring an egg to him, which might bring him, take him off the island, might take him to the shores of the island. Either way, I feel like with episode five, we know from previously being the flashback episode, next episode has some table setting to an oh my God moment where things change. And then we stop and we go back and we get some more information about how the Maginot crash was maybe purposefully executed.
Yeah.
We just learn more about Morrow's character because maybe he needs to arc out so he dies horribly in some sort of way.
Or maybe Morrow needs the egg because he's working with the aliens and needs to infect someone to create the next xenomorph.
Very, very possible. Or he knows that the xenomorph will like clean itself up, so he makes an egg somewhere else and this lung beast is going to be something else entirely.
Yeah.
So I am very interested to see what happens there. But in terms of what I could carry over, I'm just on Toodles watch. That dude, he's not in enough stuff. He's just listed as a guest star in this week's episode and not to, you know, carry over to other television shows, but if the dude is super important, he should be a star all the way through. Why is Toodles on the sidelines?
Toodles, you're in danger, girl.
You're in danger.
Dangerously curious, that character. I think I agree. And I also agree with the fact that I think this next episode is going to be another table setter, with a big shocker at the end of some kind. And I imagine that'll have something to do with, well, and who knows? I mean, slightly stealing an egg and giving it to Morrow could be enough to get them all locked up, right?
Yes, that's very true.
You know, and whatever happens to Toodles could be part of that or separate from that. We will definitely see. We'll have to wait and see. But I like the idea that we're going to spend. I like the idea that the show, I've seen folks complain a little bit about the pacing. And we even talked about it last week, where it's like, it's a, under different circumstances, I think I would criticize this show for being a little slow. But I'm liking the lore. I'm liking the world building that they're doing. And like you said a little bit earlier in the pod, I'm liking the parts of the alien mythology that this show is interested in are speaking to me. So yeah. I don't mind that they're slow rolling it a little bit. And I think that a table setting episode will work hopefully just fine, because we're going to spend time unpacking more of the lore of these, you know, five species that have now been brought to this island before we get again into full Jurassic Park mode, where the creatures get out and it becomes this full blown disaster situation. So I dig it.
It's going to be super fun. Well, it's going to be fun for somebody.
not for the human finally, characters.
You had this question in our creature check-in, but I moved it here because it's technically not about alien Earth. Mm. But as we close out this week, as we have previously, which is, what are the odds we see a Yautja? This is the name of the predator species in the alien universe. You mentioned, is Audrey 2 also seen in the Predator Badlands trailer? I went back and watched. Are we talking about the aggressive plant vine animal that is seen grabbing things?
I actually screen capped it. Let me throw this here into our document.
Yeah, because I do think
there's been some speculation more that I've seen that the
with the little barbs.
Yeah, that this barbed plant guy that the predator in the Predator Badlands trailer is fighting looks in some ways like it could be related to our Audrey 2 floral guy that we've been tracking that has not opened up yet in Alien Earth. So I think that's something interesting to watch. I don't necessarily fully see the parallels, especially because when I went back and watched the Predator Badlands trailer again today, I'm like, this plant is huge that he's fighting.
Yeah.
So maybe
it has like vines like punching him for multiple directions and stuff.
Yeah. So, but it is curious. And I do think that it is worth continuing to be vigilant about whether or not there are things that we can see that will parallel between these two properties. Because again, we know that Weyland-Yutani is present in Predator Badlands. Is there any predator stuff present in Alien Earth is like top of mind as I'm watching this show. Because, you know, this show will be done airing well before November when Predator Badlands comes out. So,
well, the Predator Badlands trailer that this is in opens with Dakota Fanning's Elle Fanning's character waking up, and it says like Weyland-Yutani Bioweapons Division, which is the whole division we don't know exists right now, but definitely would if they know the alien exists.
Sure.
So I think we're headed in that direction. I also am not sure that this is the Audrey 2 in the Predator Badlands. I think based on how much we've been shown Kirsch and Toodles' interactions, I think the Audrey 2 sucks up Toodles and just starts digesting him in that little pod.
And then maybe gets big. And
maybe it gets really big.
Could very well be this plant. And you know what? That would mean that the Maginot had been to the Yautja planet, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah. Or whatever planet the Yautja is hunting on.
Yeah, the Badlands.
I don't know if that's the Yautja planet. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Because we haven't seen Predator Badlands, but sure, we will later on in the year after we have seen the rest of Alien Earth. I can't wait to see if a Yautja shows up. I think the only thing we can count out is they were not on the records of the Maginot. There was no Yautja because it seems like we captured the five species that they have records of.
If,
so
if there
sorry
is
person
one,
that heard clicking before.
If there is one, they've been in cloaked mode the entire time.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know how he got to Neverland. We'll have to find that out in the Predator flashback episode. He says he's joking. I don't know. I don't think that's happening.
But we do have. Awesome. I mean, again, Noah Hawley has lied to us once before. So
much lying. So we will see what actually is to come on the Alien series next Wednesday. When Alien Earth Episode 4 Observation comes to our Hulu devices. Until then, take care of both your lungs. Government doesn't own them. Don't let them own them. Mm-hmm.